Good afternoon, Clear Creek County. Welcome to the What's Upstream Show. I'm your host, Mark Cuccinella. Here's my co-host, Lori Beckel. Lori, let me turn your mic up. There you go.
Very good. Hello out there in Cagoat Land.
And we have Christine Bradley in the house again. We're going to talk some history today. But first, we are Clear Creek Radio, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9 on your FM dial. And newsflash, you can stream us worldwide 24/7 on clearcreekradio.com. And on that page is a page for the archived shows over the last 3 or 4 years. They're on there, and you can pull up all the history of Clear Creek County and all the other shows that we've done. And don't forget Morning with Mozart. That's on there, too.
And do you want me to sing the What's Upstream theme?
Because please, I do, Chris.
All right, what's going up? What's coming down? What's going through our town? You want to be good?
Hope it don't flood.
What's upstream? About 80% of it.
All right. Well, and the reason that we did that live is that we've got a little bit of technical trouble with the computer this morning, but we've got all the human bodies in place and ready to go. So, Chris, welcome once again to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I wanted to quickly do one of our PSAs.
Oh, please.
If you wouldn't mind.
No, yeah. Not at all.
Yes, I forgot.
We've got a few today, so we've got to get them in. The first one is announcing an ecumenical Thanksgiving service. On Saturday, November 22nd at 6:30 p.m. at the United Center, join us for a meaningful evening of music and worship to support our local food pantry. So I'm guessing that they are asking that contributions to Loaves and Fishes would be encouraged, and that there is a bake sale and fellowship to follow. So this is hosted by the United Church of Idaho Springs, the Anglican Fellowship of Idaho Springs, and Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church. Thank you, Mark.
Yes, and you know, I'm going to guess that they would take a contribution of food, non-perishable food, or even money, right?
Yes, exactly.
Or even money, because, boy, the food bank can multiply it. If you give them $10, they can buy $70 worth. Oops, I need to talk into this microphone thing. Hi.
That's exactly right. Your money goes further. For sure.
They need everything forever at all times, however.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're short a buck, a can of soup, it would be welcomed, anything. So, all right, Chris.
Hi, here we are. When last we met, no. So, first of all, we really miss Lou Howard. Lou, if you're listening, man. Golly, it's just easier to have two of us here. And while one person is going through something, the other person can be organizing what they're getting ready to say. But these two kind folks are here and will attempt to get me through the next hour if I wander off in various directions.
Well, it's very noble of you to come in on your own. It's a lot of work but look at the sheaf of papers you got there. You look prepared.
I'm prepared. Hopefully it will come through. So one of my favorite topics, I mean, I've got a bunch of really strange topics out there, but with regards to Colorado history and Clear Creek history in particular, is the botanists. Now, that's not something you think of when you're looking into historic research and everything else. You don't really go into a town and say, so, how about them botanists? But up here, we did. But, you know, when you look, Greg Markle obviously loved history, and he really enjoyed studying the early surveyors. And all of those professional folks that we don't always think of, if you are, you know, you're watching a movie or a Gunsmoke or something else, they're always talking about, you know, the people coming across in the Conestoga wagon and all of that. But around and within that, there was a whole just texture, a mix of other folks, and in this case, some of the professionals that really fascinate me. So I'll start off by asking if either of you can name a mountain in the county named after a botanist.
Bancroft?
Oh, no. He was actually, I think it was after the historian Bancroft. But, okay. How about Greys and Tories?
Really?
Oh, uh-huh. Really? And Perry. Yeah.
Perry. I think Perry is the one I was
and
thinking.
And James and Trelease and Bethel and Engelman.
Wow.
And they are all botanists.
How about that?
How about that?
Yeah.
It's probably some women in that.
I've got information on one woman botanist who was up here, Alice Eastwood, that I'll get to a little later. Mm-hmm. But one of the first botanists to come out here I think he's here in 1860, at least by 1861, is Perry, Charles Christopher Perry. And he stays over in Empire for a while, Mark.
Good man.
Neck of the woods, good man. But he's here, and he starts by naming peaks after his mentors. But he was out of Iowa, and one of the books that he is supposed to have read was by Edwin James, and so we know James Peak and the James Peak Range. That's Edwin James, who was the botanist who came along with the Stephen Long expedition. Mm-hmm. And that's in 1820, and in 1823 he publishes a book called Account of an Expedition from Pittsburgh to the Rocky Mountains, performed in the years 1819, 1820, and then published in 1823. Now, he was the first one to make note of the Colorado Columbine, just as an aside.
Really?
So if you are Charles Christopher Perry and you're sitting back in Iowa and you've been reading that book and you knew about it back in 1823 and now there's gold in them there hills, people are starting to travel to the west. What an adventure it must have been. I think of it as just a whole different range of, literally a range, but botany and what you're finding with flora, fauna, and everything else. Mm-hmm. If you'd been studying botany in the eastern United States, I think the highest mountain is Mount Washington, and that's under 7,000 feet, so a little different by the time you get out here. So Perry, I've got to read this. See, the other thing that we do is we read things other people have written so that we don't have to do it. But this is a rather delightful study of the botanical king of Colorado, Charles Christopher Perry's Mountain Legacy, in a publication called The Daily Gardener. I love this one. And it was written August 28, 2019. And starts off with, "My dear Green Thumb Companion, today marks the birthday of a most remarkable plantsman, the one and only Charles Christopher Perry, crowned the King of Colorado Botany, who graced this earth on this day in 1823. Now, before I forget, Empire, I believe that Perry stayed at the Peck House. I think that Sally showed me his name in a register once, but sometimes my brain makes up things. Yeah. So, darlings, our birthday boy discovered both the Torrey Pine and the Engelmann Spruce, names that whisper of the illustrious mentors who shaped his botanical journey. Though Perry danced with academic luminaries, his heart belonged not to the ivory tower, but to you and me, the everyday dirt diggers and bloom admirers. In 1845, while still a fresh-faced college student, Perry studied under the magnificent John Torrey. He formed a delicious friendship," that's a great term, "he formed a delicious friendship with Asa Gray, another of Torrey's proteges. By 1848, our botanical hero was learning the trade secrets from none other than George Engelmann, that dazzling star of the Missouri Botanical Garden." You're beginning to get the feeling of why these mountains are just suddenly popping up with these names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
"Sweet pea enthusiasts, imagine the summer of 1862 when Perry, like a horticultural Pied Piper, led Elihu Hall and J.P. Harbor on a Colorado expedition. The trio gathered 10 complete sets containing over 700 specimens, a collection that, according to William Weber, who was a professor up at CU, remains the largest ever made in Colorado in a single season. What ambition, what dedication. For 20 glorious summers, our beloved Perry nestled himself in a cabin between Torrey Peak and Gray Peak." I think it's actually down at the base of it. I don't think he's up at 14,000. It may have been the Kelso Cabin down on the road down there.
Stevens Gulch,
yeah. My fellow flower lovers, isn't there something utterly romantic about naming geography after those who shaped your mind? Hmm. He even named a mountain after his wife, Eva Peak, and another, Mount Flora, a man after my own heart, it says here. In 1870, after what must have been a thrilling visit to England, Perry met the botanical maestro of the age, Sir Joseph Dalton Hooker, director of the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew. It was the esteemed Hooker who bestowed upon Perry the magnificent title King of Colorado Botany. But Colorado couldn't contain our Perry's passion. He traversed the West with the enthusiasm of a child in a sweet shop, amassing over 30,000 specimens for his herbarium.
Good man.
Yeah, imagine that collection, dear she shed besties. I love the way this lady writes. 30,000 botanical treasures. Anyway, don't you just feel the moonlight on your face, my garden companion? So, it's an introduction to Charles Christopher Perry. But he's obviously very important to this area, and he starts off by naming these two beautiful, big, beautiful peaks after both Gray and Torrey.
Hmm. I think, Chris, is there not an Engelmann Peak,
yes,
too?
Yes, there is. There's
that series of peaks from Bard,
yeah,
kind of going,
yep,
north.
Yes.
And
yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. And James and Trelease. The Trelease family still owns a cabin in, well, it's a small home, in Georgetown.
Okay.
Bethel, who was a noted botanist and teacher at East High School, and Engelmann, who at one point, Kelso Mountain was called Engelmann, but he lost out to Kelso, but they find another one for him. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine Gray and Torrey sitting back in their academic worlds and wondering about these mountains that have their names.
Mm.
So, indeed, they come out to see them.
Mm.
And in 1872, Asa Gray comes with a party, and they decide to climb Gray's Peak.
Mm.
And this is in 1872, a party of 21 with Asa Gray and wife, interesting proceedings on the summit of Gray's Peak is the title of the article. A party of ladies and gentlemen visited Gray's Peak from Georgetown on the 14th of August. The day was calm, clear, and beautiful. Some of the party, in order to lighten the toil of the journey, left Georgetown on the afternoon of the 13th, and the others joined them early in the morning at Bakerville. Now, can you imagine getting from Georgetown to Bakerville early in the morning without a car? Because I'm beginning to, as I read this trip, I'm thinking if I could take my four-wheel drive up to the trailhead,
yeah,
I right, might be, anyway.
I always think of that, Chris. Whenever I think of people just coming here from, where was it, Iowa?
Yeah.
Getting here from Iowa, how'd you get here, walk?
Yeah. Well, in 1872, so it's before the train.
Yeah.
So it would have been by stagecoach. And I'm guessing that they probably took some kind of there wouldn't have been a stagecoach, but there certainly would have been a wagon, perhaps.
A wagon,
but
cart.
How long would it take you to take a wagon from Georgetown to Bakerville? I ask you this. Anyway. Okay. So the party consisted of the following persons. Professor Asa Gray with his wife from Cambridge, Massachusetts. C.C. Perry, who was in St. Louis, Missouri at that time. Reverend Green, who was from Greeley, J.H. McMurdy and wife from Georgetown, Dr. Mumson from Empire, you see you're still mm-hmm. represented here, D.S. True, S.F. Smith and wife, Putnam, Davenport, Iowa, Thayer and wife, Miss Kaiser, Davenport, Iowa. I want to know who she is and why she's here. She's the only one.
Friend of a friend.
Oh, she would be a friend of the Putnams, I bet.
Yeah.
R.S. King, New York, R. Martin, Reverend John Cree, and Reverend Professor Weiser from Georgetown. This highly intelligent party reached the summit of Gray's Peak about 10 a.m.
How in the world?
After pretty hard climbing.
Yeah. And without hiking boots. I can imagine the,
can you imagine the women?
Shoes they were wearing.
Yeah, and the women.
And the boots.
And corsets.
And corsets and everything else. So anyway, they get up there at 10 a.m. having left Georgetown, that morning. After looking around for some time, and having been agreed upon without the knowledge of Professor Gray to hold a meeting on the top of the peak to give him a cordial welcome. The meeting was called to order by J.H. McMurdy, Reverend Cree, and then one of the oldest citizens of Colorado was called to preside. R.L. Martin of Georgetown was appointed secretary. So one of the oldest Anyway, I was still thinking about these guys hauling it up there, and one of the oldest citizens of Colorado is one of them. So McMurdy made a few appropriate remarks in reference to the peak and its position. He stated that it divided the waters of the Pacific from those of the Atlantic, that this famous mountain had been called Gray's Peak in 1862 by Professor Perry, and the peak on the north had at the same time by the same person also been called Torrey's Peak, and that attempts had been made recently to change the name of those peaks without any good reasons.
No way.
Well, Richard Irwin, there was Torrey's was originally known as Irwin's Peak. Now, depending on who you talk to, either Torrey's was named first or Irwin's was named, but in any event, attempts had been made to change the names without any good reasons, and he hoped this would not be done. He stated that our Army and Navy were represented, and also our explorers and our clergymen in Pikes Peak, Sherman and McClellan Mountains, and Beecher Mountain, and that our scientific men should also be represented.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. He was, therefore, in favor of Gray's and Torrey's Peak. McMurdy then proposed that Professor Weiser now welcome Professor Gray to the summit of the peak, whereupon the following address was delivered to Professor Gray amid the most profound attention. I'm still back to these guys having hoofed it up there by 10 o'clock in the morning.
This is unbelievable.
It is. Yeah. And Professor Asa Gray. Anyway, Professor Weiser. There are two Weisers in Georgetown. One is a reverend who is also a professor, and then his son was a dentist. And so we have Dr. Weiser and then Professor or Reverend Weiser, but I like it when they call him Reverend Professor Weiser or Professor Reverend Weiser. Mm. So he says, here in this gleaned field where it was thought 40 years ago nothing could be picked up but a few worthless pebbles, you, sir, have gathered diamonds of the purest water. You, with your honored teacher and lifelong friend Dr. Torrey, have perhaps done more to simplify and enrich the science of botany than any of your predecessors. And in saying this, we do not wish to undervalue the labors of those illustrious men who have gone before us. It was your good fortune to be born in the first decade of the 19th century, when all the sciences began to assume a more practical form. It required 200 years in the English world of letters to introduce fully the inductive philosophy of Bacon into the sciences.
That's great.
I thought it was just
great.
Oh,
my gosh.
So, I mean, do you really think of this as you're watching the traditional Western movie of people coming west? And here we are up on top of Gray's Peak talking about the inductive philosophy of Bacon. Anyway, for your labors.
I know what that is.
For your labors in systemizing and arranging the science of botany upon the broad basis of common sense, your countrymen have honored you. Standing as you do with your illustrious co-laborer, Dr. Torrey, at the head of your Department of the Natural Sciences, your name and meanery, I'm not sure why that, what, your name and meanery deserves to be handed down to prosperity with honor as one of the chief promoters of true science of your day and generation. I mean, they're just, it's a wonderful world that's happening there. And we do need to remember all of the other flavors that were out there when it comes to early settlement. Yes, you've got prospectors who are out there with pickaxe and mule, but then you've got Asa Gray just happened to come out to visit and climb up his mountain.
You know, it just makes so much sense to me. Because I think of course, you've got prospectors,
sure.
and before that, people who were harvesting furs.
Yes.
The natural resource extraction folks came out.
Yeah.
But who's going to follow? The people who are quantifying the land,
yeah.
And you're going to have scientists and lawyers and
yeah.
and then social. Activities like the preachers are
yeah.
all going to be there.
They're all going to be part
yeah,
of it.
You're going to build a society. You know, you start with the people who are trying to get away from society, and the society just follows you right out.
Well, and by so, the time you get into, and we also need to remember that, of course, generation upon generation of indigenous people who would already have known the names of all of these plants.
They had their own names,
wondering
right.
what on earth, you know. But,
yeah.
but we thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So what that's, they would be doing. And the number of these botanists who started off as doctors and then really decided it was more fun to go into this field, and they were looking at what types of different plants might be used in healing and all of these other kinds.
I think that that's an interesting acknowledgement of the development of the scientific method.
Yeah.
And you know, a whole new world has opened up just recently in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And these guys walked through that door. And imagine Gray's excitement as he's discovering lichens and mosses and flowers and
collecting the samples and how carefully they would have done all of that.
Exactly.
And the fact that so many of them still exist. Yeah, I just, and there's old C.C. Perry discovering, I'll call that pine Torrey pine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
right.
He didn't know it would be a golf course in California. Or Engelmann spruce, those sorts of things. And what a sense of adventure that would have been. Here's a new one. Anyway, so that's Professor Gray hiking up to the top of his mountain at that time. Mm. Now, 100 years later, so in 1972, William Weber, Professor Weber from University of Colorado, and some of his students and some of the local Georgetown folks decided to climb the mountain again in his honor, and they all went up there. And I was not here at that time, but I remember my friend Ron Neely, who did climb it, which is amazing. If you knew Ron, he was not known as a mountain adventurer. Mm. And he carried the champagne. So
I bet they didn't get up there by 10.
I bet they didn't get up by 10. I couldn't. Anyway.
So, Chris, maybe you're going to talk about this, but those specimens that were being collected back in the 19th century, I guess.
Right. Yeah, these are the 19th.
Yeah, and then they went. You said they
they're,
went.
They're different herbariums.
Somewhere.
Each one of them. So Asa Gray's herbarium is now at Harvard.
Okay.
Dr. Torrey's went to the New York Botanic Gardens and then some to the Natural History Museum in New York. C.C. Perry's are in Iowa, I think in Davenport, Iowa.
Hmm.
But these amazing collections, and I mean tens of thousands, and you can imagine the number that have been added to it from there. We had a wonderful Devil's Gate talk a couple of weeks ago. By a woman, Barbara Thier, did I write her name down, who did a program called Herbarium. And she worked decades at the New York Botanic Gardens with the Torrey collection. So I mean, we're all sitting there like, wow.
That is really
cool. You worked
cool.
with all that stuff.
Yeah, and having really hiked most of the mountains you're talking about and appreciating the flora out there.
Yeah.
This conversation makes me wonder how much it's changed.
Which is why you have the collections now and why they continue to collect.
And compare?
And compare, yeah.
Okay.
And then they also, in this program that she did on herbarium, which you can watch on the library's YouTube channel, if you get on the library's main page, go down to the bottom, there's an icon for YouTube, and you could hear Barbara's discussion of herbariums and the work that they continue to do. They even do DNA work with some of these early samples.
And that's what makes that so valuable. It was valuable in its day to catalog what was on the ground here in Colorado in the mountains, but it has become actually more valuable today because now they can compare and contrast what's out there.
Yeah.
To your point, Lori, what's out there today, what are the impacts of our developments, the impacts of climate change
and
all the rest.
Yeah. Everything else.
And that's the that's the standard.
You imagine the amount and the numbers of specimens that just keep growing exponentially and having to take care of them, having to maintain put things in acid-free settings with temperature and humidity controls and all of that, and obviously the cost associated with it. And when we go through times where people aren't all that interested in science, how do they make sure that it's still taken care of? But let me tell you a little about Dr. Torrey and then maybe take a break.
Yeah.
Is that separate?
Yeah,
in 1872, we had Asa Gray coming up, but then his professor was Dr. John Torrey, and he passes away in 1873, and there's an article about him in the Colorado Miner. We noticed in our telegrams yesterday the death of this distinguished naturalist, Dr. Torrey. Dr. Torrey was a gentleman of high literary and scientific attainments. In the Department of Botany and Chemistry, he had no superior in America. And in botany, he has for the last 20 years been second to no other in the world. May be said that for half a century, he has been the great teacher of botany in the country. Professor Asa Gray, who by the death of Dr. Torrey now becomes the first botanist of our country, was a pupil of Torrey's and very freely admitted the superiority of his honored teacher. He was an extensive traveler, this is Dr. Torrey, having made the tour of Europe several times and was everywhere received by the scientific men of England and the continent of Europe. In the latter part of last summer, being 1872, in the company of one of his daughters and a distinguished literary lady from Norway, Miss Duet, he made a visit to California. And on his return in late September, he came to Georgetown. Now, I always like these guys who are traveling around the mountains in late September. Can you? It's leaf-looking season. I'm just saying there are some traditions that have been here for forever.
So obvious.
Yes. The party spent 4 days here. Their names are recorded in the register at the Barton House on the 19th of September. The old gentleman was anxious to see the peaks near Georgetown that were named after him and his distinguished pupil and fellow laborer, Professor Gray. And on the 21st, a party was organized and started with a view of scaling those magnificent peaks. But when they reached the height of about 12,500 feet just above timberline and about 2 miles from the summit of the peaks, the old doctor found that he could go no higher as he had great difficulty in breathing. But he insisted upon the party proceeding, and he remained at the foot of the mountain until others returned. He enjoyed the ride to the foot of Gray's Peak very much and said it was one of the grandest views he had ever seen. We write these few thoughts immediately upon having heard of his death before anything concerning his history has come to our knowledge as a small contribution to the honor of one of our most distinguished literary men. The time of the death, we think he was in his 77th year and was government essayist and professor at Columbia College, New York.
Well, 77 years old, he can be excused for not making the summit.
Not making the summit by 10. Yeah. Anyway, should we take a break? And when we come back, I'll tell you about a young woman, Alice Eastwood, who's up in that neck of the woods, along with an older gent, Alfred Russel Wallace.
And we'll be back with that information in just a moment. Okay. This is What's Upstream here on KGOAT Radio, and we are KYGT LPFM 102.7, 103.9 on your FM dial, streaming over clearcreekradio.com. Lori Beckel, what do you got?
Well, I have another PSA, Mark and Chris. This one is the Clear Creek County Town Hall, which will be a state and local policy recap of 2025 and a preview of the state legislature's work in 2026 with our Senator Dylan Roberts and our Representative Leslie Smith will take place on December 8th, 2025, 5:30 to 7 at the United Center, right downstairs from where we are right now. So again, please mark your calendar to come and join us for the town hall. This is sponsored by the Clear Creek Democrats. However, everyone is welcome, and we encourage you to attend. There will be a meal deal for $10 while they last. So if you show up early, you might be able to get your dinner here. And we will also have Heidi McCollum here, who is our district attorney, and our Clear Creek County commissioners will be here as well. It'll be great to hear from them because they're going into their budget season. They just are swearing in our new sheriff today. Mm-hmm. Whose name is Ron Thornton. And so lots of really positive, good things going on in this county. And during this holiday time, it'll be a great time to celebrate these things.
Lori, the last time we had a town hall, I broadcast that live from up here, and maybe I'll see if I can make it to do that again.
Oh, that'd be great, Mark.
Yeah,
you
think
could.
I will.
Yeah, so again, December 8th. 5:30 to 7 here at the United Center.
Okay. We are back with our illustrious guest, Christine Bradley, and we are talking about a subject of great fascination, and that is the investigation of our mountains by the original botanist pioneers of the United States. And I will say this about hiking in the woods: the more you know about what you're seeing, and the more you can appreciate what mm-hmm. What you're part of as you hike yeah. through that. And you know, that's the way I feel about art and music and literature. The more you know going in, the more you can appreciate what you see. So Chris, thanks for bringing us up to date on some of these people who we've heard their names many times, and we just never appreciated who they were.
No, or who knew that the mountains were really named for the botanists. And Earl and his wife, Carrie Scott Ellis, wrote a book called The Saga of Upper Clear Creek, which is a comprehensive history of the area west of Silver Plume. Mm-hmm. And it's not the kind of book that you sit down to read. It's not a page-turner, but it's an amazing reference document. And he's the one, when I was looking through this book, that suddenly made me, he started talking about the number of botanists and then the botanists who are actually here. And I'd never thought about it. I mean, I just heard these mountain names. And again, you know, we were talking about, we have Gray, Torrey, Perry, James, Trelease, Bethel, Engelman. I mean, it's a considerable number, and quite a number of the mountains. We were talking off air and saying, is it the same other places? And I'm not sure. I wonder about early explorations in California once you get the 1849 gold rush, and did they mm-hmm. have people going out at that point in time, or is this just a matter of timing? Now, I would say that Clear Creek and Gilpin counties were really important very early, and that's why they're so tiny, by the way. Mm. Both counties are small because when they originally divided the county in the state into counties, they wanted them to have equal value. And so the high mineral resources of Clear Creek and Gilpin then were offset by something like, I don't know if it was Summit, but some of the ones that went all the way, the huge ones on the western slope.
Yeah, the ranch counties. Lands.
Right.
Yeah.
And
east.
Then,
and
east, the same
too.
Way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you look at the 1861 maps when the territory is formed, you've got these two itty-bitty counties up here, which are, you know, Gilpin and Clear Creek.
that describes Denver County as well, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah. So then through the years, they end up splitting it more based on population. But
that is so interesting.
When you think about that and the fact that it's an 1859 world, as the extractive minerals, as we were talking about, as those folks are coming out, and they're coming here, but they're hearing about Central City and Blackhawk and Georgetown and Idaho Springs. And then, so these professionals are coming out here as well, and what the excitement must have been for them. Mm-hmm. They'd been gathering herbarium materials for herbariums for, I think, hundreds of years before that, if I'm remembering Barbara's talk it accurately. However, it really starts gathering momentum at our time.
Hey, excuse me, Chris. I just want to give a sense of the scope of work that this was, because you know, we mentioned earlier that they had that expedition up to the top of the mountain at 10 by 10 o'clock in the morning. But you know, they collected thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of samples. And think of the hiking around in the mountains, the camping out in the wilderness that they must have had to do. And it literally was wilderness then. And you know, it gives you a deeper sense of how much work it was just to make these collections.
And how do you determine which ones are the same? I mean, maybe it's just because I'm such an amateur at all this, and I sort of have, you know, as I go out, it's like, that's a daisy kind, and this is a lily kind, and that's a lupin kind.
Well, that's better than most. Yeah. Good for you. But you develop an eye.
You develop an eye, but for these folks, and a lot of them were also doing sketches, taking notes of where they were going and everything else. Well, one of the, how do I start into the story? So, a few years back, a woman named Amy Schneider was up in Georgetown, and she had apparently been looking for me and going around town asking people for information on the Bakerville area, or on Greymont, she was calling it. And we have very few people that would come up and say, what do you know about Greymont? But I finally was settled in one place, and so they directed her to me. And she came in and said, do you know where the Kelso Cabin was? And I said, well, I know it's up Stevens Gulch from Bakerville, but no, I don't know where it is on the ground. Well, she was interested in that cabin because a young woman botanist by name of Alice Eastwood had gone up there a couple of times. Alice Eastwood was a professor at East High School in Denver. And, well, let me give you a little of her. She was born in Toronto in 1859, moved to Denver as a young teen. Her love of nature, especially plants, grew during long hikes in the Rockies. I bet she could get up there by 10. She was a talented student, graduating from high school as class valedictorian. However, her family's precarious financial situation precluded the possibility of higher education for her. Instead, she taught high school, but continued to spend as much time as possible exploring the plants of the Rocky Mountains on her own, and she developed a local reputation for her trail experience and plant knowledge. When Alfred Russel Wallace visited in Denver in 1887, it was Eastwood who took the famous tropical explorer, then in his 60s, on a three-day hike to Gray's Peak. So Wallace was a naturalist, explorer, geographer, biologist, illustrator, and he did research sort of along excerpts from Charles Darwin's earlier writings. So he's also one who's going to be talking about that whole, you know, field of work. And so he ends up coming out, and he's going to be going to California. Anyway, he comes, and he's looking for someone to take him up to the mountains. So Amy Schneider, who works for Denver Botanic Gardens, was interested in Alice Eastwood because she has some of her, I think she's got some of her notes. She may have some of her collections, I'm not sure. But she was wanting to know where Alice was, and she wanted to learn where the cabin was and everything else. So she and I became buddies as we were trying to figure things out. And Well, let me give you a little more about what she does then with this gentleman. So here she is with Alfred Russel Wallace, who was born in 1823. And so, I mean, he's in his 60s, but obviously he hikes a lot too. But I think that 10 o'clock is going to be a figure for me. So anyway, when Alfred Russel Wallace visited Denver in 1887, it was Eastwood who took the famous tropical explorer on a three-day hike to Gray's Peak. Gray's Peak and the adjacent Torrey's Peak were first ascended and named by botanist Charles Perry. We know that. Shrewd investing of her modest teacher salary in real estate generated enough income that by the time Eastwood was just 31, she could quit her teaching job and devote herself full-time to botany. She used her newfound freedom to travel to San Francisco.
Clever woman.
Clever woman. We'll get back to that. But she is up there, and so Amy is interested in what route she took and everything else. And she and a couple of her cohorts decide they're going to, I know I have to talk into the microphone, hello, that they're going to attempt to go up and spend time in Stevens Gulch and attempt to see where they went and all of that. Okay. So she's up here in the year following her talking to me, and I had gone out in order to find the Kelso Cabin. You hear things like it's upstream from Bakerville. It's in the vicinity of Grizzly Gulch and Stevens Gulch. Well, that kind of, you know, leaves you a pretty big area.
Right.
Well, I was able to find, I found a picture of it, but you couldn't really place it on the ground with that picture very easily.
So, Chris, how long ago is this?
Oh, this is going to be like 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
Yeah.
Recently.
Yeah. Oh, it's recent that we're trying to figure out where it is. Mm-hmm. And so I found a mineral survey patent. And if you've ever done anything with mining claims, mineral survey patents, the hey, Greg.
Yeah.
He's looking down. Mm-hmm. They would mark improvements on the patent. So I started going, I figured it had to be near the creek, and I started my way down with all of the claims that were coming down the creek. And lo and behold, I found one with the building that was the same size. As the Kelso Cabin, on a claim that was owned by William Kelso, who won out over Engelman. Anyway, so I knew where it was, and I could take that claim and use the county mapping system, thank you, Matt Taylor, and figure out about where it was on the ground. So the weather's nice. Frank Young, Barb Downing, and I decide we're going to go up, see if we can find it on the ground. So we're going up. And if you ever went hiking with Frank, Frank was always looking down. He was looking for old you know, cans and bottles.
He'd find them, too.
And he'd find them. And Barb Downing had done work in archaeology, and so she and Frank were the two off on the side with their heads down.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at mountains and trying to figure out where would you put a cabin and those kinds of things. And I think we're pretty close. So I'm back in Frank's Jeep, and I'm looking at my notes. I look up, and here come three young people walking down Stevens Gulch Road, one of them with a piece of paper, and I thought, no, nobody hikes with paper other than me. So I went out and I said, are you looking for the Kelso Cabin? Well, it was Amy that I'd talked to a year before. Neither of us knew, and we just both happened to be there the same day. But they were up gathering specimens.
That's freakish.
And it was, anyway, it was great fun. So she's still interested in that, and she's trying to figure out exactly what time we got here, where they hiked, and they met up with somebody up near the top who had a cabin up there. I've jumped back a century. Alice Eastwood and Alfred Russel Wallace had found a place to stay with some miners way, way up, probably about 13,000 feet. Anyway, so she's all involved in that. In the meantime, I get to know a little more about Alice Eastwood, because this woman, after she leaves, she's now gathered up some money and notoriety or whatever, and she goes out to California. And she becomes very well known around San Francisco. So from an article called The Women in Science Archive, which has some really cool-looking people on it, including Jane Goodall. Hi, Jane. boy, her service last, okay, never mind. So an article, A Bay of Botany, Alice Eastwood's 9 decades and 300,000 specimens. Okay.
See?
So this is a young woman, no college training, who was teaching at East High School, who then happened to run into Alf. Anyway. April 18th, 1906, an Alice Eastwood's lunch bag hangs casually from a mastodon's tusk while outside a proud city burns. So this is after the earthquake and the fire that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
This is the morning of the great San Francisco earthquake, and Eastwood's first response is not to secure the protection of her own home and valuables, but rather to run to the Academy of Sciences, where she is the curator of botany, and work against the growing blaze to save the treasure trove of specimens she has spent her life collecting and organizing for the institution.
Wow.
The marble stairway leading to the botanical workrooms is broken, so after hanging up her lunch on the nearest prehistoric creature, she pulls herself hand over hand up the remaining bronze banister, finally reaching the top and dashing to her office, making split-second decisions about what can be saved and what must be sacrificed, while from the window she can see an unstoppable wall of fire slowly crunching down upon the academy.
Horrible.
Wrapping up samples from century-old collections, the 47-year-old curator and Western flora expert rushes up and down the banister, organizing the rescue efforts, hiring carts to bring the scientific treasures up the hill and away from harm, bossing around the police who try and fail to prevent her re-entering the endangered building, and keeping her Zeiss lens firmly in her pocket as the one object in the world she absolutely positively cannot be without.
Can I tell you what that is?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's those, you see that occasionally in a show where the little lens that they carry usually around their neck, and it's about this big around, and they'll hold it up to their eye to investigate more closely
kind of
specimen.
A magnifying glass.
Wow.
What's
that? Is
that
what it is?
Yeah,
magnifying glass.
A little, I used to have one of those.
Cool. Well, that was the thing that she, as it said, absolutely positively could not be without.
You got to have that. Right?
When fire finally ravages the academy and eventually her private home as well, she takes solace in having saved 1,497 crucial specimens, even as her book lover's heart aches at the thought of the academy's priceless collection of rare scientific texts, now nothing more than ashes on the wind.
Wow.
Wow. Alice Eastwood was tough. Like if Wolverine in a pile of rebar and concrete had a daughter, tough. What's that? Like if Wolverine in a pile of rebar and concrete had a daughter. Okay. She was going on adventures in her 70s and 80s, before which healthy 20-somethings often quailed. She was part of California botany's storied age. Only way to get rare desert plants was to load up a horse and ride into the unknown. In later life, she'd tell harrowing stories of... take 15-hour stretches up nearly vertical hills while collecting in Montezuma Canyon with rapidly vanishing provisions, of huddling in a shack in the Yukon while waiting for the blooming of the willows, of losing her footing while trying to cross a mountain river and having to swim against the current, threatening to send her over a waterfall, of using her expertise in walking on top of quicksand to gather a rare specimen, and of eating oatmeal made with water fouled by cattle excrement just to have something to eat. Wow. She could out-hike everybody in the exclusive San Francisco Cross Country Club, I bet, a fact they conceded when they offered her the only membership ever extended to a woman. On expeditions, she was cook, organizer, lead scientist, a field guide in one, and designed a new form of skirt that would allow her to ride and collect and still meet the marvelously arbitrary fashion expectations of the day. Though the fact that her skirts ended at the ankle instead of at the floor was viewed with steady and scornful askanceness by those who live and die by monitoring such things.
Whatever.
She was also a Latin teacher who spent time at the end of her life translating some of the deep treasures of the botanical records into accessible English, a choral performer, a shrewd businesswoman who managed to preternaturally keep her investments on an even keel, even in the depths of the Great Depression, and the author of over 300 botanical articles, 200 of which she wrote after age 50.
Well, now, why doesn't she have a mountain named
Miley
after her?
Thought exactly.
Well, by the time, well, I think, is Perry gone by the time she's here? He may have passed.
Yeah.
But you know, she should. She may well have one in California.
Yeah.
I think that she's better known for work in San Francisco.
Yeah.
However, her, I think, now this is where I have 10 pieces of paper too many. Alice Eastwood's legacy is at the CU Herbarium.
Mm.
And that, at least a good portion of it. So University of Colorado Herbarium houses the world's most complete documentation of Colorado flora. Located in the basement of the Clare Small Arts and Sciences Building, the herbarium's collection contains nearly 600,000 specimens of vascular plants, bryophytes. Those are the ones that I think some of the real serious guys are really into bryophytes, right? Lichen and fungi.
Right.
The herbarium's founding collections date to the 1880s and belong to Alice Eastwood, a self-taught plant scientist. During her life, she named 395 species, the fourth highest of any female scientist. Interesting. She served as a teacher in Kiowa, spent summers collecting plants, and obviously we know she was at East High. She wrote, in 1893, she wrote a book, A Popular Flora of Denver, Colorado, who wrote that she created the publication, quote, with the sole aim of helping students to learn the names of plants that grow around Denver. Her collection lived in the Colorado State Historical Society in CU Boulder's Herbarium, which is part of the university's Museum of Natural History, acquired it under curator William Weber in the 1940s. William Weber, by the way, was just, he falls in my category of neat guy. He came up and did a lecture for one of our early Devil's Gate programs, and that lecture is available on our library digital website. And he was comparing plants of the Altai in Russia, and the Rocky Mountains. And he's just, he loved plants, he loved nature, and he was really into bryophytes. Anyway.
Cool.
So that's what I have on these guys.
Well, I just find...
it's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. This Miss Eastwood, she... you know, not only was she so highly accomplished in her career, but think of the prejudice that she faced. I mean, even into the 60s, you couldn't be a scientist and get a PhD from Harvard.
You had to really...
It was crazy.
It was crazy. Well, there was that Madame Curie who had made an impact in it. But again, these are women who have to have blinders on because they're being told no, and they're just doing it.
Yeah, there were exceptions, and she's one, and Madame Curie, of course, and the woman who helped Hubble discover his discoveries. I forget her name. But you know, there were exceptions to the rule, but these were anomalies because the world that was structured to stop them from ever accomplishing those things.
Yeah.
So think of the tenacity and the talent to do that
and to keep doing it. And
good for
you know,
her.
One of these days maybe in December we'll talk about Isabella Bird, another one who's out there and just amazing. And again, how on earth did they do it? And somehow, do they just have an aura, which is, I'm doing this because I'm doing it, and you can either help me or I'll do it myself.
That's a great question.
But
how do they do it?
And did they have families that supported them, or did they have families that sort of went, I don't know.
So, Chris, have you ever been to the CU Herbarium?
No, I haven't. And I haven't been to the one at Denver Public or Denver Botanic Gardens, which I should, because Amy Schneider is quite wonderful, and she's the one who told me about Alice Eastwood, and she learned about Alice Eastwood from Barbara Thier's book on herbariums, and so now we're all sort of around there and having great fun talking about these kinds of things.
Well, and the other thing I'm thinking about, and it may be up to Mark to make sure that the Open Space Commission knows about a lot of this history, especially the history up Stevens Gulch, which now the
Open Space Commission, part of the county's properties now.
And part of what I was wondering, if Open Space ever kind of sees a role in sharing through plaques. I'm thinking of the work on the Santiago mine.
Sure.
And the sort of sharing that history.
This is something that we have talked about. And, you know, when you look at the list of things that haven't been done with open space and the tasks in front of us, it's just, you know, you have to prioritize. And one of the things we are doing this year is we're on the open space agenda is a signage on the properties and historical markers.
And so
you can expect to see more of that kind
more
of thing
of
throughout the community. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and three cheers for K-GOAT, by the way, because these kinds of programs, and the same with the library district, these programs are now recorded. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of how do we get the word out to people to listen to some of them.
Yeah.
And then also I need to make up a bibliography of some of the books and articles that are out there that have this sort of information. But there are really some wonderful possibilities between the open space at the head of Stevens Gulch, and then you've got the Silver Plume Mountain Park and possibly the Taylor Kennedy property adjacent to that. Mm-hmm. And when you're going up Guanella Pass, all of the properties on the, what's it going to be, east side of Leavenworth Mountain that are largely under public ownership. And I've been working with, a few people, on history of early black mining in that area. But what's possible now with QR codes and all of that, where you don't even need big plaques are great for explaining where you are and this sort of thing. But those little QR codes, so you can change and upgrade information as more becomes available.
I think that's part of what our strategy is going to be.
Yep.
Is just make people aware of what they're looking at and then have QR codes to develop
some of the details.
So that
it could be a QR code that ties into Barbara's program on herbariums or my wonderful discussion here this morning. But or Frank Young talking, I mean, the Frank Young Devil's Gate program where he talks about the history of open space in the county. I mean, that should be something that every open space member has access to, and other people, the new open space director who I've been chatting back and texting back and forth. Anyway, there's good information out there, and the thing is people do love it, and they like knowing more about the history, as long as it's not just sitting in a classroom and somebody yelling dates at you, you know. Let's look at where we live and what's here.
Makes it live.
Yeah, it should.
Yeah.
That's the good kind, anyway. That's why we do this program on What's Upstream. So I guess we're going to be back December 31st?
Yeah. We'll be the last thing that you hear on K-GOAT for the year. It'll be great.
Wow. Yeah. That's okay.
What are we going to talk about?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know that I have enough to do the theosophists. there was one of the gentlemen who started the theosophist movement was in Georgetown.
So please.
I can't explain it.
Well, can you define the word?
No.
I don't even know what that is.
We'll have to look it up. I just know that people would come into my office at the archives and say, I heard Franz Hartmann lived here. And they were like Franz Hartmann groupies. So anyway, there are a lot of topics, and I'm intrigued with doing some of the professionals, so maybe we do the physicians that are here and those kinds of things too. So we'll go from there, and then when Lou gets
But
the joy of doing this with Lou is we have the balance of Idaho Springs and other things.
Yeah.
And I tend to be less site-specific and just more, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway.
Chris, we've got just a minute left, and I wanted to ask you to get your comments about the library moving into new digs right there with you.
Right with me. I'm excited. I know that nobody really likes change, and there's that, but that's such a wonderful old building, and there's going to be more space for the library, and I think the children's program that could happen there. Just think of Friday afternoons when school's out and they could be doing matinees in that little public performance area, that sort of thing. So the thought of kids running up and down the stairs again. Now, I tell you that when Buff Rutherford went to school at the Georgetown School, he knew that the reason that the high school was upstairs because it was the high school.
Chris, thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure. Lori, isn't it
so great? Chris is such a wealth of information.
Absolutely.
She's a treasure.
I'm in awe.
Starting lineup of the 64 Yankees. I mean, I've got words to Teen Angel.
All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us. And we'll be back next week. Who have we got next week, Lori?
Next week, we have a show focused on beginning the holiday seasons in Clear Creek County.
Okay.
So we'll look forward to the Tourist Bureau and Sadie Schultz will be here.
We'll be looking forward to that. And don't forget the Georgetown Christmas Market is coming up. That's always a lot of fun.
First two weekends.
Yeah, there you go. First two weekends in December. All right.
Okay, does Chris sing again?
I'll be singing at the Hamel House.
No, I mean our What's Upstream.
What's going up? What's coming down? What's going through our town? Going to be good. Hope it don't flood. Oh, it's What's Upstream.
Thanks, folks. Bye
now. Thanks for listening.
Bye. All right. Fun stuff.
Really interesting.
It's just.